Hello, I'm Richard Kilgariff. Welcome to Bookomi. Now, the OMI in Bookomi, as you know, stands for the original memorable insights that we find in books when we connect with the most wanted minds in business, science, technology, and culture. In this episode...
Hi, I'm David Epstein, author of Range, Why Generalists Triumph in a Specialized World, and this is my OMI for Bookomi.
The number one New York Times bestselling author who specializes in the science of performance, but wants us all to explore the wider benefits of a broad experience if we are to become the very best at whatever we do.
So I do think it takes a lot of practice to be great at something. I think throughout one's life, advantages, competitive advantages continue to accrue to people who are less narrow than they have to be.
David Epstein, welcome to Bookomi.
Thank you very much for having me.
As with all complex ideas, David, people asked you to sum up the concept of range, benefits of breadth, in one sentence, and this led you to write the book. I'm not going to ask you to sum up the book in one sentence, but I am going to ask you to share two or three insights that occurred to you in the writing of the book that you didn't have before you started. What light bulbs appeared over your head as you set about the organizational challenge of producing Range, the book?
I would say kind of the concept that I think is at the core of the book to me is that whether we're talking about developing a particular skill, preparing yourself for the modern rapidly changing work world, deciding what to even do with your life, there's a huge amount of research evidence that shows that what looks like an apparent head start in the short term will often undermine your long-term development. And whether that's just developing a skill in most areas, or plotting your career, or even choosing what it will be, that we often opt for a head start, even though expanding our skill set, which takes longer, is better in the long run. So I think this trade-off between short-term head starts and long-term development is sort of the core theme of the book.
And you talk about how we apply our knowledge and experience and our short-term and long-term activity and thinking in wicked and kind environments. What do you mean by wicked and kind?
I'm glad you asked that, because that will further frame what I just said, which is those are terms I took from the psychologist Robin Hogarth. And what he meant by kind learning environments were those where next steps and goals are clearly set out for you. Rules are clear and don't change. Patterns repeat. When you do something, you get feedback that's accurate and quick, and work next year will look like work last year. So golf is one of the early examples I use in the book. On the other end of the spectrum are what Hogarth called, and it is a spectrum, are what Hogarth called wicked learning environments. And by wicked learning environments, he meant domains where the next steps and goals may not just be given to you. Rules may or may not be enumerated. They may change. Patterns don't just repeat. Feedback may be delayed or inaccurate, and work next year won't look like work last year. And, you know, we can think about which one of these situations are we increasingly finding ourselves in. Both, for sure, some of both. But more and more modern work is geared toward the wicked. And the reason Hogarth came up with these is because there was this disagreement, this fundamental disagreement in scientific research on expertise development that showed in some areas people just keep getting better with specialized experience. But in many others, they not only don't get better, if they're too narrow, they become more confident, but not better, which is a bad mix. And so in these wicked learning environments, it's actually having a broader skill set that makes you adaptable to these sorts of changing circumstances that are increasingly relevant to modern work.
And you say creative achievers tend to have broad interests. And you mean the very top of creative achievement and scientific achievement, don't you? I suppose when you're talking about the very top of the field, in terms of Nobel Prize winners, for instance, how do we avoid, though, further down the ladder slightly, becoming a jack of all trades and a master of none? How do we focus on the game or the job and maintain healthy cognitive diversity?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that question, because actually this is related to a question I get a lot and informed the afterword that is coming out now with the paperback of the book. There are two things I want to mention. First, just because I have a lot of interest in a digressive brain, you mentioned that jack of all trades, master of none. The long version, the full version of that phrase is jack of all trades, master of none, oftentimes better than master of one. But I think it's sort of culturally telling that we lopped off the back half. And by the way, the first written use of the phrase jack of all trades as an insult was Johannes Factotum in New Latin, and it was an insult leveled at a young poet who didn't have formal higher education and was trying to be a playwright and help run an acting troupe and et cetera, and do all these other things. And that was William Shakespeare. So he turned out okay, despite someone insulting him as a jack of all trades. But to move on to, I think, your main point, how do we embrace some of the tenets of range or expanding our skill set, you know, when we're not a Nobel Prize winner, and don't make ourselves so diffuse that we're not useful in most of you know, the normal walks of life? And I think relevant research to think about, again, I described this in detail in the new afterword, was done in a dozen different countries where people were matched for their parents' years of education, their own years of education, and their national test scores. And these were randomized samples. Two-thirds of these people had no tertiary education whatsoever. So we're not talking about Nobel Prize winners. And some of the people, the only difference was some got career-focused, specialized training, and some got broad general education. And the pattern in 11 of the 12 countries was that those who got the career-focused education were more likely to be hired right out of training, more likely to have a higher salary right away, but so much less adaptable in a changing work world that when there would be changes to their industry, they would end up either out of work for a long time or with slow growth rates. And so over the course of their working life, they would win in the short term and lose big in the long term. And the faster changing a country's economy was, the greater the advantage accrued over the lifetime to the people with that broader base. And I think that is kind of symbolic of a lot of the research trends I tried to highlight in the book, where these actually do apply to, it doesn't mean that we don't need specialists at all, but that increasingly, as the work world changes more rapidly, right? Like a Fortune 500 company 50 years ago had an average lifespan of 60 years. Now it's like 14 years or something like that. Everyone has to reinvent over and over and pivot from things that might have worked yesterday, but don't work anymore today. And I think the data strongly suggest that that people's work lives are changing more rapidly over the course of their own lifetime. And that broad skill base is kind of an irreplaceable advantage for adapting to that.
In our lifetime, most of us have grown up with the mantra that practice makes perfect. And the earlier we start practicing, the better. Later on in life, the earlier we start, the better we'll be in whatever field it is. You challenge that theory by comparing the careers of Tiger Woods and Roger Federer, for instance. What can we learn from their trajectory to greatness? And when is it too late to start doing something to a seriously high standard in life?
And so I used Roger and Tiger early on as sort of these thought symbols, right? Tiger Woods being the classic early specialization example, you know, started imitating a golf swing at 10 months old. And in contrast to that, Roger Federer, who dabbled in a whole bunch of different sports, liked to have a lot of unstructured play time, didn't end up specializing in tennis until several years later than a lot of his peers. And both of these are obviously examples of massive success. What my question was which one of these is the norm? Because we focus on the Tiger story to the exclusion of other stories. And obviously there's huge, tremendous individual variability in people's paths. But the research in sports, because I was the science writer at Sports Illustrated at the time when I got interested in this, showed that the Roger path was the norm. And yet even tennis enthusiasts don't know anything about his background, whereas we all know the Tiger story. And so my question was kind of, why are we focusing on the exception all the time? And I think the answer is because it's dramatic. And also because it seems like this tidy narrative that we can extrapolate to anything we want to be good at in life. You know, I think that's a huge mistake because as we discussed, golf is a very kind learning environment, turns out to be a kind of a uniquely horrible example of almost everything else that humans want to learn. So I think we've been extrapolating from the wrong example. That said, I do think practice is really important. In fact, Malcolm Gladwell and I were on stage a little while ago, and sort of at the end of the discussion, because we became, after I first criticized the 10,000 hour rule years ago, we actually became running buddies and would talk about it on our own time. And I said, you know, has your mind changed? And he said, yes, I think I made an error of conflating two things. One, the idea that a lot of practice is important to become great, which I think is true, with the idea that implies early specialization, which I now think is false. And so he and I are now on the same ground, where I do think it takes a lot of practice to be great at something. I think throughout one's life, competitive advantages continue to accrue to people who are less narrow than they have to be. You know, it's a hard way to quantify. In a lot of the domains of research, I look at they quantify it in their own ways, depending on what they're studying. But I think while it's often important for people to have sort of an anchor in an area where they feel comfortable, then taking skills from that area and bringing them to ones where they're less familiar, or taking things from other areas that are less familiar and bringing them into that core area, is sort of the hallmark of people who have fast growth rates. You know, it's certainly been the case for me, right? I was training to be a scientist, got off track, ended up as a temp fact checker at a sports magazine. And it was very much my oddball background that was ordinary when I was among scientists was suddenly extraordinary when I was among writers. And so I don't think we should think of it in terms of deadlines of sort of it's too late for me to start, because what you're really doing is over the course of your life is you are constructing a toolbox. You're not starting over. You're layering things on top of what you already know and finding the most useful combinations. So that's kind of how I think about it. Instead of, I'm too late to start, I think of it as, what can I take from here that will add to things that I'm already competent with?
Yes, it's like if you only do something to the exclusion of everything else and only have one tool, and you quote in the book, I forget the historian who says that no tool is omnicompetent.
Toynbee, yep.
Toynbee,
no such thing as a master key that unlocks all doors.
Yeah. That's right, and it's a great way of putting it. And as we prepare for the acceleration of the machine age, and that when anything that can be automated will be automated, what do humans still have to offer? You say the more a task shifts to an open world of big picture strategy, the more humans have to add. Is this because machines are, as far as we know, incapable of abstract thought?
That is part of it. Machines are poor at generalizing. So for example, actually, this has been some companies that have contacted, you know, that I've had some contact with through the pandemic, were under the impression that they, you know, purchased AI systems basically to say, predict. One of them that contacted me was been trying to predict consumer behavior, you know, the most common use of AI is like targeted advertising, which seems like a great accomplishment, except it's only a great use because false positives don't matter, right? So when you move that kind of AI into an area where false positives matter, suddenly it doesn't look as good anymore. But anyway, so this company contacted me and said, in the pandemic, they had gotten like, people started searching food condiments more often than they normally did. And that threw their entire AI system off kilter, right? So a fairly pretty pedestrian change to people's behavior that I don't know why that was the case, messed up their entire algorithm. And I think that's kind of emblematic of how AI really works, where it is trained, it's trained on a certain set of data. And then if the data that it has to use in the future looks exactly like that training set, then it's great. So sort of like chess, where you see repetitive patterns. If that's not the case, then things often go really, really wrong. So a good example was like Google's flu trends in 2009, where they published to a lot of a huge fanfare in the journal Nature, you know, arguably the most prestigious in the world, that they had used search query data to predict the spread of flu in the United States in this case, as rapidly and accurately as the CDC. So great. But then it started getting less accurate every year because it turns out people don't just search the same stuff at the same time every year, right? It depends on the news and it depends on that season's symptoms and who knows what else. And by 2013, it had missed by over 100% and they shut it down. And if you now go and look at the holding page, it says, it's early days for nowcasting. So get in touch if you want to, you know, talk to us about it. They're not doing it anymore, right? There was no fanfare about that, like there was about the 2009 paper. And so I think these bigger picture, sort of when human behavior is involved and strategic thinking about how to implement automated systems, humans still have enormous value because whenever something changes, they go off the rails. This can be simple stuff. There was just a really neat paper that tested some of Google's image recognition software, its neural networks, the most advanced image recognition software, to see how easy it was to kind of make it get things wrong. And it's very easy. Like when you showed it a school bus, it could 100% identify a school bus if it was sitting parked and facing the camera. But if the school bus was on its side across a snowy road, then it thought it was a snowplow. Right, so things that a child would recognize instantly, it gets fooled by because it's not adaptable. It's not good at generalizing. It's only good at doing en masse things that it has done before. So Jeopardy, right? IBM's Watson crushed at Jeopardy. 95% of the answers to Jeopardy questions are titles of Wikipedia pages. So it's a perfect problem for brute force search. But then IBM used that success to market it in things like healthcare research, and it was a total disaster, because those are problems that require sort of human strategic thinking to figure out what are even the right questions, not just searching for already known answers. So I know I'm going on long about this, but I think a model to keep in mind is the ATM. In the 1970s, when the ATM came online, all the news coverage said, oh, bank tellers are going to go out of business. There'll never be any more bank tellers. And again, I was looking at US data because that's where I'm based. And over the next 50 years, in fact, as there were more ATMs, there were more bank tellers, because each branch became cheaper to operate. So there are fewer tellers per branch, but more branches overall. But it fundamentally changed the job of one from someone who does repetitive cash transactions to someone who's a customer service representative or a marketing professional or a financial advisor or whatever. So it offloaded the repetitive part of the job, so that the human could focus on these, what sometimes people call soft skills, but I would call durable skills, on this more strategic part involved with human behavior, and focus on what we're better at. So in industries that have implemented more computer systems, they've actually had more job growth, but it shifts the job growth to these less repetitive tasks that require more adaptability, if that makes some sense.
How you're describing it there is very optimistic. We are at an inflection point, aren't we, in terms of industries and work? And we all change as we grow, most notably as we move from adolescence to adulthood. And then we seem to get stuck in our ways doing the same job, maybe for more money if we're lucky, rising to the top of our field if we work hard and get a few breaks. But for many people, this isn't enough, is it? Why is that?
Yeah, and to start with your point about optimism, that's definitely true. And I should say, throughout history, these technological change dislocates a lot of people, no matter whether it's good in the long run or not. And the scholar James Besson writes about how the technological change we're going through now is no more disruptive than technological changes have been in the past, but it's coming more rapidly. So it's occurring to people multiple times through their lifetime. So they're having to be retrained. But that idea of why is it not enough? I think something that's important to keep in mind is the so-called end of history illusion. This is this psychological finding that at every time point in life, we will say, oh yeah, I changed a lot. I changed my skills, my beliefs, my desires based on my past experiences. I've really changed and learned a lot, but now I'm pretty much done. So the change coming in the future will be much less to how I spend my time, things I like to do, what I think I'm good at. And at every time point in life, we're wrong. We always underestimate future change. It's like we're a work in progress, always claiming to be done. Now, personality change does slow down. The most rapid period of change is about 18 to about 28. So it does slow down, but it never stops. And we continually underestimate it. And so I think when you realize that, the idea that you would stay doing sort of the same thing and continue to be equally enthused about it doesn't make much sense. If that's the case, it's probably just luck. We change even in our own interests and in our own what we think our strengths and weaknesses are. And if there's not a workplace that allows us to capitalize on that self-knowledge, right? I think we sometimes incentivize people to forge ahead despite what they learn about themselves and what the lessons that they've learned. And so I think we're setting people up to not be able to capitalize on their life lessons sometimes in a way that they should. And so I don't think it's very surprising that it doesn't feel like enough, right? So often people end up almost forsaking the idea of fulfillment in their work and just chasing kind of the next raise, which is fine. I'm not to denigrate people making more money, but sometimes I think it's sort of a fallback goal once they've kind of given up on finding better, match quality. Again, that term I use a lot that describes a degree of fit between someone's interests and abilities and the work that they do, which turns out to be extremely important for their sense of fulfillment. So I think we don't have systems that recognize how much people really change and empower them to use that knowledge to find a better spot for themselves.
Yes, historically, it was the preserve of the entitled and the elite, wasn't it, mm-hmm. to find a job or work a working life that matched your aspirations and your sense of self. Yeah. Maybe we're in a moment in time now where we can redefine terms and redefine work and redefine value in the workplace and wealth distribution, work, you know, time distribution. You even go as far as I would say to reclaim the word amateur in the book, the amateur mindset, a bit like the beginner's mind that Buddhism speaks to.
Right.
And you point out quite right that it comes from the word to love. And you say that we need to keep the mindset of the amateur. What do you love to do when you're not investigating stories or writing best-selling nonfiction books?
I love doing things in nature and I run a lot. So those are important things to me, although it's related to my work because often when I'm stuck, I go running and like answer. Things come to mind that for some reason I can't access when I'm not running. I don't exactly know why. One of my psychologist friends who studies creativity tells me it's because when I'm running, I sort of deactivate some part of my frontal cortex and it activates something called the default network. So you can like work on problems that way. I'm not steeped in that area, but that's what I like to do a lot. But I also keep what I call a book of small experiments where just like I did when I was a grad student in science, I have a hypothesis that I want to test, but in this case, it's something about me. Like maybe something I saw in an article, I said, that sounds like an interesting field or maybe some skill I want to learn. And so I'll put down, you know, I think I would like whatever skill, and then I find a way to test it. Sometimes that's as simple as making contact with someone in a field that I don't know. Sometimes it's more involved by taking a class. So like in the course of Writing Range, I got sort of stuck in the writing. I love reading fiction. I think it has more diverse structural challenges than nonfiction. So I think, you know, to try to improve my own writing, and I just enjoy it. I read a lot of fiction. And so I took a beginner's online fiction writing course, like just 101, you know, nobody cares who you are, what you've done. And it was great because suddenly I went from feeling competent to feeling incompetent. And there was an exercise in the class where you had to write a story with no dialogue at all, a whole story. And this, I had been doing in traditional investigative reporting for the 3 years leading up to this. At a place called ProPublica. And in that kind of reporting, you use lots of quotes. Your lawyers want you to put things in other people's words when possible. So it's very quote heavy. And I realized I had been stuck in that mode that I was used to, using too many quotes. When in the manuscript for Range, I was often using quotes to paper over things I didn't understand well enough. And I realized I had to go back, understand those areas better, take out tons of quotes, replace them with more clear narrative exploration. I think the book got, you know, I leave it to other people to judge, but I think it was better than it would have been for that. And that came out of something really unexpected where I took this fiction writing course. And so one, I loved it. So I want to do more of that as a hobby. I've taken up drawing recently also. But I'm constantly sort of setting up experiments for myself. And I think this relates in a sort of tangential way to what we were just talking about people and their satisfaction with their jobs. I think there should be, I've been in a lot of workplaces where decision makers tell people that this is good, like spend some of your own time, explore some other interests and skills, but they don't allot any time for it. So it's just something you're supposed to do on your own time, which is a losing proposition, you know, unless you're self-employed like me. And I think that's a mistake because there's these, I think it's called Parkinson's law, this idea that an amount of work will expand to whatever time you give it. And that when we reduce the formal working hours in a work week, you can reduce it a reasonable amount without losing any productivity. And so I think we should do that and use some of the saved time to help people set up these personal experiments for their enjoyment and skill building. And I think we'd end up with better results overall. But again, like so many things I write about, it's deeply counterintuitive that we could spend less time doing exactly what's in front of us and get the same or better results.
I think it's really interesting to compare, as you do, how businesses or organizations strive to become more efficient with the brain and how we internalize or externalize what's going on in our brain. You know, when we do the same thing day in, day out, we may get bored with it. We may get tired of our jobs. But if we go on holiday or we look at it in a different perspective or we even change the color of the walls, we look at it afresh and we have a new, different, or diverse way of looking at it. We have another tool in the box, like you say. You talk about cultures, business culture in the book, and how they aim to become more congruent, to, you know, be all pulling together, just like the brain does from birth. The brain tries to become more efficient. It tries to make sense of everything. And then it relies too heavily on process and pattern recognition, on consistency. How does a business protect itself? How do we protect ourselves against that natural inclination to learn from the past without challenging the present or the future?
That's a great question. And that, what you mentioned about the brain, I always think of it as like the cookies on your browser. You know, as you go to the same pages over and over and over, you get cookies on your browser so that you can get to those pages faster. But you're trading flexibility essentially for efficiency. And I actually don't think that has to be zero sum competition. So I think we can do things, you know, we could go to the same websites and get those cookies, but we could still find ways to reach outside of that. So in fact, I'll get to the business in a sec, but we do that trade occurs naturally when we're young, where we trade flexibility for efficiency in our brain. But think of people who grow up multilingual. In that case, they trade it for a much broader efficiency, right? So I think if you keep that breadth, you can have much broader skill set with efficiency. So it's not just a zero-sum trade-off. But in terms of businesses, that congruence, that's right. This is what people are generally taught in business school, to create cultures that are congruent, which means like all the cultural signals go in the same direction. You know, maybe it's a hierarchical structure, or maybe it's a flatter structure organization, you know, and maybe everyone is supposed to follow rules. Maybe everyone is supposed to be individual thinkers, whatever it is, all the cultural signals just are aligned. And people like that. They report that they have some comfort in that because it gives them clarity. The problem is it causes them to create certain predictable errors. So when a culture is congruent for what's called outcome accountability, which means people there only feel like they're going to be held, you know, evaluated based on their outcomes of their work, they will commit so-called mistakes of reckless deviation, meaning they will always be sort of freelancing and never having learned from the past and not using any of the team's experience. On the other hand, when they feel that they're only being held accountable for the process by which they make decisions, then they commit errors of mindless conformity, where they will never freelance. You know, they will always use the rules that have been set out for them and the things that worked again in the past. And the problem is, and that's fine if you're in an environment where you're just doing the same thing over and over and over. But if you're not, and you need people to learn and adapt, then you want them balancing between errors of deviation and errors of conformity. And the way to do that, the research shows, is to breed incongruence, which basically means sending them mixed cultural signals about how they're being held accountable, whether it's for their outcomes or whether it's for their process. And so there's some of each, and they aren't totally sure. And you can balance this by, maybe you have a very independent culture. You know, it could be like programmers who are, you know, independent and all creative on their own. And so they're only being really held accountable for their outcomes. But then informally, they have a very cohesive social culture. So they feel obligated to one another. And so that breeds some accountability for how they're going about things. And when you have this incongruence, it actually causes people to start learning from their mistakes, and they get better and better over time. The negative side is that people tend to say they don't like it. Like, they prefer congruence, although they perform better with incongruence. So there's a little bit of a conundrum there. But my opinion would be to optimize our performance rather than people's comfort.
Yes, and if you're very lucky, you enjoy the excitement of constant change and being challenged. This idea extends further into talent acquisition, doesn't it? You echo the first book, actually, we featured on Bocomi like nearly 10 years ago. You might have heard of it, The Rare Find by George Anders.
Yep.
And you point out that the founders, as he did, of the biggest tech companies today wouldn't make it through the current recruitment processes of those tech companies. Surely, though, I think about this a lot, actually, when I'm in and out of tech companies. They're not looking for other founders. They're looking for highly efficient thinkers who will execute their strategies, surely, just as Kasparov collaborated with a computer to beat another computer.
I think there's a lot of truth to that. You know, I think it depends on what stage they're in. And then you can see kind of very large companies where they have almost segmented some of this. So you look at like Alphabet, right? Google's parent company, where they obviously have certain operations that have an enormous amount of momentum, and they need people to sort of work on known things. But at the same time, I think they realized that leads to a sort of rigidity and non-adaptability. You know, it leads to the situations whereby large companies, you know, seemingly strangely get disrupted by very small ones that are more agile. And so they started internally their X project, which is a huge operation that is to kind of try to continue that of smaller teams, that's trying to continue sort of that founder mentality and approach, and using these sort of polymaths and people across different disciplines. And so I think this in some ways kind of gets at that kind wicked dichotomy, and where you have certain problems, you know, you just need to work on in a specialized way. And then you have areas where you need to be adaptable and have people bringing in new information. And so I think that's an example of a company that's sort of trying to have both. And that's probably the best situation you can put yourself in, is if you can afford to have some of both of those things. And I don't think by any stretch of the imagination we don't need specialists. I think I feel very much about it in the same way, you know, along the lines of the quote that the eminent physicist and mathematician Freeman Dyson, that I quoted late in the book, where he said, we need frogs and birds. You know, the frogs are down in the mud, seeing the granular details of problems. The birds are soaring up above, not seeing those details, but integrating the knowledge of the frogs. And as he said, we need both. The problem is we increasingly tell everyone to be frogs and not to be those integrator birds. And that makes us less and less flexible. And that's, I think that's a quite good image for how I think about it.
We actually met Freeman Dyson's son, George Dyson.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he's written a book called Analogica. It's fascinating. And he's a fascinating man, as you would expect, being the offspring of Freeman Dyson. And also Esther Dyson is an incredibly brilliant woman who works in a tech investment and is a polymath in her own right. But we digress, David. We digress, which is our want.
I always digress.
As
digressive as my book is, that's actually my brain organized.
Well, I did notice that, because I could feel all the way through the book that you wanted to go off into each field, but you were pulling it back in there.
I had to cut like 30,000 words of digressions.
But it's all the better for it. You say in the book that seeing only the small pieces of a large jigsaw, no matter how clearly or precisely or in such high definition as you might see them, isn't enough to grapple with humanity's greatest challenges. And that's where we are now, isn't it, with COVID-19, one of the greatest challenges we've faced as a species for a long time. But we don't even have all the pieces of the jigsaw yet. We're just piecing it together bit by bit. Amongst the scientific expertise today, how do we find what you call the beacons of breadth?
You know, it's interesting, because a character in the last chapter of the book, Arturo Casadevall, who is one of the most prominent immunologists in the world, and I wrote about him because he's starting a program to educate scientists to sort of de-specialize them early in their careers and give them sort of broader analytical thinking tools. He ended up leading the national, and then, you know, spawned international collaboration, convalescent plasma project for COVID, which is this operation to use the blood plasma of people who have recovered and produced antibodies and use it to treat people who are still ill. And he's also set up a, you know, study of it. So we'll find out, there's randomized controlled trials going on, so we can find out how efficacious it is or isn't. But this has been, you know, nobody knew, obviously there's still lots of unknowns, but there were all unknowns at the beginning. And what he saw was that we were about to be in essentially a pre-vaccine age as far as this virus was concerned. And so using his knowledge of science history, he decided this convalescent plasma was an approach we should try. And in about 3 months, went from non-existent to having treated over 50,000 people. And I think this was very much the case because he had worked with people from so many different disciplines over the course of his career, that he was able to bring together a national and then international collaboration, even though he's not a virologist, very, very quickly. And so in that case, you know, he didn't have to have all of the puzzle pieces in his own head, but he had such an expansive network that he could draw in people who could sort of then internally run this import-export business of ideas where people started trading information and all these sorts of things. And not only scientists, right? I think one of the, I don't know if this has been quite the same in the UK, but in the US, there's been this like ongoing battle about COVID between, oh, the epidemiologists say we have to do this to save lives, and the economists say we have to do this to save the economy, which will in turn save lives. You know, so it's the epidemiologists say we have to save these lives to in turn save the economy, and the economists say we have to save the economy in turn to save these lives. And it's so obvious that they are both using the dependent variable that's most important in their field, when in fact it's clearly the answer is like a synthesis of these things. And so I think some of the people who are synthesizers like Arturo have been sort of ahead of a lot of the things that are going on, where they realize that we need to bring in multiple disciplines. In chapter 10 of the book, I write about the so-called super forecasters. These people who are these very broad generalists, just sort of normal people, sometimes with an area of expertise, sometimes not, who need specialists, but they go to them for facts, not opinion. And then they synthesize those specialists' opinions to make decisions. As the leader of this 20-year-long research project said, they have dragonfly eyes. Dragonfly's eyes are composed of thousands of different lenses. Each one takes a different picture and they're synthesized in the dragonfly's brain. And if you Google Time Magazine and eerily accurate forecasts, COVID-19, you will see an article about those literal people from that study who have been outstripping all of the experts by a mile in making their COVID predictions. They're not virologists. They're not immunologists. They reach out to people with specialized expertise and they synthesize their approaches across disciplines. And so even without all the jigsaw pieces in place, they're doing a lot better than anyone else. So I encourage people to Google Time Magazine, eerily accurate predictions, COVID-19, and you'll see the exact literal people I was interviewing about forecasters for chapter 10.
And also, maybe we should encourage everybody to vote for some super synthesizers or super forecasters to lead our countries, if we can find them.
Those people change their minds like crazy, which is punished in politics, right? So one of the guys in the article who, there was a scientist who, you know, one of the experts making predictions actually tweeted at one point, you know, what the, and then a curse, how does he keep doing this about Tom Lipte? Because he kept beating the expert panels and predictions. Tom has when he makes exact probability predictions of how likely he thinks something will be, and then he forces himself every day to move his probability up or down 2% so that he's not just trying to confirm his thoughts from the previous day and falling into confirmation bias. Forces himself to go up or down. So he's always changing his mind, which is like, you get the death penalty for in politics, right? And so it's like we're purposely selecting for people who make the worst predictions when we demand people who never flip-flop on their positions.
Well, David, when are you going out for a jog with Malcolm Gladwell next? Is there any chance we can join you?
I would love to have, you know, we were both national level runners. He's older than I am, but he trains more, so we make a good match. He was a Canadian provincial champion. I mean, he's like a borderline world-class runner for his age group. We're both huge running nerds. And, you know, since social distancing, though, we haven't seen each other. So hopefully sometime in the next couple months. And in all seriousness, you know, aside from the running, if we're running really hard, there's not much talking, but before and after there is, and we love to have conversation partners. So you would be seriously 1,000,000% welcome. We would love it.
Could be the first peripatetic podcast run at speed. He was one of the, last in-person interviews we did actually for Talking to Strangers, and a great guy to meet in person. I just imagine you jogging around Central Park or New York looking for broken windows or stories or narrative nonfiction ideas.
It's funny because, you know, the introduction to Range is called Roger versus Tiger. And that came out of, if you see, he and I, the first time we ever met was at a debate at MIT in 2013. It's up on YouTube. And we were talking about this specialization pattern in sports where actually the future elites usually delay specialization. And then we went, you know, running the next day for the first time where we started becoming friends. And we started talking about this as the Roger versus Tiger problem. Like that's how, you know, because he's really good at coming up with those phrases. He's like, okay, this is going to be the this problem. And we're going to talk about things under that. And so that phrase that came up while running ended up being the title of the introduction of the book.
One of the tragedies of the pandemic is being cut off from people. And it's been a great pleasure speaking with you today, even if it's virtual and digitally, David. Thank you for sharing your OMI with Bokomi.
The pleasure's all mine. I've done a lot of interviews, but a lot of these answers I feel like were fresh because you asked very pointed, you know, and capacious questions. So I really appreciate that. You obviously read it very closely.
David Epstein's book, Range, Why Generalists Triumph in a Specialized World, is available to buy now. Just follow the link in the description of the podcast. And if you'd like to be the first to hear and meet the brightest minds behind the smartest new nonfiction, sign up to our monthly most wanted email at bokomi.com. Meanwhile, if you enjoyed this Bokomi pod, please let us know by following or subscribing on Apple, Spotify, and Google audio platforms. I'm Rich Kilgariff. Stay safe. And remember, great leaders are wide readers. Bye for now. Thank you.